Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother wasn't able to read this book, so she's not joining us today. She didn't get a chance to, but she'll be back next week. Our guest today is Carol Ann Davis. She is a poet, essayist, and author of two previous poetry collections, and the book that we're talking about today is a collection of essays titled The Nail in the Tree. Carol Ann is the daughter of one of the NASA engineers who returned the Apollo 13 crew from the moon. She grew up on the east coast of Florida, the youngest of seven children, then studied poetry at Vassar College and the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. She's a former longtime editor of the literary journal Crazy Horse. She is professor of English at Fairfield University and director of the Fairfield University Low Residency Masters of Fine Arts program. Her work has appeared in the Daily Beast, on the website of PBS NewsHour, and widely in literary magazines. And she has read her work at the Library of Congress and many other places. She lives in Newtown, Connecticut with her husband and two sons. And if you want to find out more about her, you can go to her website, carolanndavis.org, carolanndavis.org. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Carol Ann.
Thank you for having me, Monica.
And I'm guessing that you use the whole Carol Ann, not just Carol. Is that true?
Yes, you probably figured that out from the east coast of Florida, right? Double names.
Well, actually, I just got it from the emails from your publicist. She always referred to you as Carol Ann, so I figured I should do the same.
My sister is Mary Kate, and I'm Carol Ann.
And so, yeah. Seven kids and Mary Kate, I'm thinking Catholic family.
Well, you know, that is the assumption people make, but it's the second most common thing, Southern Baptist.
Okay, gotcha.
But actually, it was my mother's dream to have seven children, and that was my father was a person who liked to fulfill dreams. So, you know, he worked at NASA, and she raised seven kids. They were both very ambitious in their own ways.
I would say so, too. And I see that you haven't tried to follow in your mother's footsteps quite like that.
Well, my husband and I both wanted children, but we also knew we wanted to kind of wait until we could, like, we both are poets, trained as poets. And so we weren't sure what the financial situation would be. So we waited until I got a good teaching job before we started having kids. So that meant just the two of them.
Okay. Well, I grew up in a family of five, and I have two children also.
That's funny.
Yeah. And it's hard for me to even imagine having seven kids, how you could handle that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the great things that I have is that I was raised by something that's almost gone now, people who were born in the 30s. So, like, they just had a different mentality about that, right? We're different.
Right.
Just a total different worldview. But I do love, now that my parents have both passed, the sense of the big family of siblings and the adult relationships I have with my siblings. So, I mean, I think you lose a little having just a smaller crew, but they are obviously, they're taken care of in a different way because there's only two. So,
well, that you've got, there is that, but there's also, there is to me, it seems like the myth of the happy, loving, large family. particularly, you know, I'm from the Midwest and particularly the large, happy farm family and
right.
The kind of the Waltons myth. And
right.
My experience in viewing families larger than mine is that that's not the way it goes down.
Right. I think it's a in fact, you know, it's funny. My siblings have been reading the book, and actually, but even before this book, with poems I would write or poems my sister would write. She's a poet also. My five brothers have different experiences. I don't think two children in the same family, much less seven or five, have anything like the same experience.
That is true. And you do write about your childhood somewhat in the book. Actually, I want to come back to that. But first, let's talk about what this book is and what prompted it. So it's a book of essays. It's sort of a memoir, but it's not really certainly not a chronological memoir.
Right.
How do you describe it?
Yeah, so it's a series of essays that form sort of a storyline, but not really, because I'm actually pretty ambivalent about narrative as a concept, which you might have noticed because it's not chronological. But the basis of the collection is that I live in Newtown. I actually lived in Sandy Hook, Connecticut on the day of the shooting. And my sons went to a neighboring elementary school. And so the essay collection is kind of born from the experience of that day and the aftermath of raising my kids in Sandy Hook in Newtown. Since then, there's one essay from before that is about raising my kids. So my children are my big subject in my essays and in my two collections of poems. And so in some ways for me, it's a continuation of a project of writing about them as they grew up. But because of the jarring and the world changing nature of that day, even though I do write a lot of poems about, obviously, from my point of view now, which is after that event, this particular event seemed to need the form of the essay. But the essays that I wrote were not formal in nature, were not chronological or thematic. They still jumped around the way a poem might. So I think the experience is still pretty jarring, even though they're essays of reading the book. But in that, back to your point about childhood, in that effort to understand what my children were experiencing, I found myself thrown back on sort of seminal childhood experiences of my own and on a meditation about siblinghood, which led into, I think, what you were talking about earlier about the way in which the book is about a big family.
Right.
You know, it's about what children go through. It's a meditation on the way in which trauma informs childhood and the way in which parents are kind of unable to stop that process from happening. You know?
Right.
That things wash over children in a very different way.
Yeah. And in I think it might be in the first essay, you talk about how, you know, you're talking about the trauma of that day, but you write and you repeat this, and this is what it is not to suffer that day. This is the not suffering happy ending story.
Right.
Do you think you could have even written this if you had been one of the ones whose child was killed at Sandy Hook?
Well, I mean, obviously I have acquaintances and friends and all over the circle of distance and proximity to those days. I was a writer on that day, you know, like I was a mid-career poet. And it takes everything I know about writing. It took everything I know about writing just to live through the 6 months after that event. And the essay you're talking about is one that I felt very strongly, I have to get this out of my body, which is sort of a writer's feeling. Like, we know we carry things and writers know to try and externalize them. So that essay came about from an experience of, from a writerly point of view going, I will know more about that day if I write the details of that day, as hard as that is to do. And I feel as if everyone who was here in this town that day can benefit in some way from that exercise of writing the details of that day. But I would never, ever presume to know, like, in what setting a person who was closer to those events would would do that. Do you know, like it may be right. more of a therapeutic setting or, but I do think getting these traumatic experiences out of our bodies and onto the page and even just into language and not like that you may have picked up, I'm sure you did, that a lot of what the book is about is acknowledging that language is actually a pretty imperfect vehicle for trying to even revisit these kind of experiences. There's just so much of it that's outside of language.
Oh, yeah. That's why I was thinking, you know, it's almost a memoir of feeling more than of event.
Right. Yeah. And actually, it's funny you should say that because I have a poem in my second book that says something like, not what we know, but what we feel. Mm. You know, like, and it's sort of an Ars Poetica about like what you're trying to do when you write is really not, not say what happened, but what it did to you.
Right. Because that's the commonality. That's
right.
What somebody else can identify with more than the right. event itself, unless they've been through the exact same event.
Well, and I think I didn't realize this till I finished the book, but, and it was totally a human reaction, but occasionally when I would tell people where I lived, which I would say I live in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, or I live in Newtown. We moved about 2 miles. We were renting when the tragedy occurred and we bought a couple years later. So I moved, like, it was actually kind of really hard for me. My husband had to say to me when I was doing our return address, he's like, "Hun, this house is Newtown, not Sandy Hook." 'Cause I had like bonded and, you know, but like when I would say like I'm from Newtown and occasionally people would say, I can't imagine living there. And it was a really complicated reaction I would have, not that I would share it with who said that because I understood where they were coming from. But the effort at imagining is sort of at the basis of all literature, right? You know, the
right.
effort to imagine another point of view is sort of, well, we justify fiction writing as the empathic enterprise of the empathetic enterprise of saying, oh, like this character is like me, even though I can't imagine it, but now I can. Now I do imagine it. So I think under this book, not in any conscious way, but I was thinking, well, there's something really important about people trying to imagine living here. Because if they push it totally away, then they're pushing away sort of the civic reality of guns in this country and different, you know, not that I'm a huge activist or anything, but like I do think the imaginative exercise of living in Newtown is an American imperative in some way. People should think about what it would be like to live here. Now, and then there's the reality of living here, which is another thing I feel really some kind of obligation to, which is that it's a beautiful town with full of loving people before, during, and after this event. And like, I love living here. And I say that knowing that this happened here. And it's just one of the most, you know, beautiful possible towns. In terms of the people who live here and the things that people do for each other. And, you know, and so like those are some of the complicated things that I would think in the 300 thoughts that you have every second, like the Buddhists say, you know, when someone would say, I can't imagine living there.
Mm. Now you mentioned activism. There is an activist group that has grown there, isn't there?
Well, I mean, there's many, many mm-hmm. foundations that have, you know, that have sprung up from the
okay.
shooting.
The one I was aware of is Moms Demand.
I don't know. You know, I can't tell you the provenance of that group. I mean, I know mm-hmm. that Moms Demand Action, I'm not positive that it came.
Okay.
I mean, Sandy Hook Promise is maybe the most well-known of the foundations.
Yeah.
But there are also many, many arts foundations and advocacy foundations that take up basically the variety of interests of the children who died are represented, and the teachers who died are represented. Many of the families have, you know, depending on what the person's main passion was, there's a foundation for it. So there are some were more political and some are more, you know, civic. I would say there's a huge range. Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Carol Ann Davis, author of The Nail in the Tree, Essays on Art, Violence, and Childhood. So let's circle back to the discussion about siblings and growing up in a large family. And
right.
There's an essay in here where you're referring to, I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Me neither.
G-R-A-E-A-E.
So maybe somebody can tell us, but I say Grie. I don't know if that's right.
Now
I should ask my colleagues.
Is this something from Greek mythology?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us what the Grie is and how you identify with that in terms of your childhood.
Yes. So the Grie, and apologies to the classicists who may be listening. You can go on my website and get my email and write to me and give me the phonetic spelling. But the Grie were the three sisters sharing one eye that guarded Perseus's shield. And so they would need to like take the eye out and pass it to the other sister to see something. And I thought that this was like, something in it spoke to me of the way that, like, that's just kind of a really wildly moving thing to think, I'll give my sight to my sibling. My sibling could do more with the eye right now, you know, for our common needs. And this has been something my siblings, as they've read it, they've thought, wow, you know, and I think at some point I named, like, this one had this talent and this one had this talent.
Right.
And some of them are trying to guess. You don't have to tell me, but, you know, was this person or?
they weren't able to know right away? They didn't see
that. I don't think so, but what was interesting about asking, like, who was nobody questioned the premise. Of the
Grie.
Nobody said, I have my talent and I never give it to anybody else. I, you know, like, this is mine. The sense of the common identity is what's so interesting to me about that myth.
Yes. Yeah. Now, when I was reading that, I'm thinking, I didn't really feel that as a child.
Right?
I didn't feel that connected with my siblings. And we have a good relationship as adults.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways we're very close. In some ways we're not. We're all very, very different people. We've gone
yeah.
in very different directions in our lives. Although not really so much. In some ways, some people would look at us and say, no, you haven't. Cause,
right, right.
Because we're mostly all independent business people. And in fact, three of us worked together in one business for a long time that was owned by my next youngest brother. And, you know, we're constantly in communication as a result of that. But,
right.
But still.
Yeah.
And,
well, I know what you mean. I don't think it's, I mean, I hope it doesn't seem idealized in the essay because I think there's pain involved too, right? Because it's like, it's about, like that essay in particular is about being led,
yes.
and surrendering to kind of like surrendering to darkness in some ways, surrendering to things that are difficult. And then there's also in that essay, I deal with this mysterious aspect of my childhood, which is, you know, that I had a lot of times where I was anorexic, and you know, the idea that you could be in that big family and people don't necessarily see it, and that there's an image in that about the hummingbird and the constant drinking and flying that the hummingbird has to, like, you know, there's something about, like, if they don't constantly drink, they could sort of fall out of the air.
Right.
And then there's, like, I think about that in relation to swimming and my brothers being really far out in the ocean and me swimming out and kind of tipping on their board the way the hummingbird would tip. And I kind of approached the idea of, like, was I almost sort of drowning, starving, whatever those terms are going to be, and who saw it. So there's, like, the grier, seeing things and then missing things. Mm. And so I think you're right that, like, no matter how close you feel, like, inside a unit like that, like, there's still some isolation.
Yeah, there is. You're right. And I know my sister told me once that she was younger. She was the fourth. I was the second. And I was sort of the second mom figure in some ways.
Right.
But that she felt very isolated, particularly as, well, the first three of us were, like, from my older brother to my next younger brother, there was 3 years. So, and I was in the middle of that.
Right.
So, yeah. So we all grew up really quickly. And the two younger then were left. And she said she had no idea what was going on in our lives when we were teenagers, when we were, and, you know, as, and certainly after we left home, but even at home. And she felt really left out by that. Mm. and isolated. And so she made a real, real effort to, she had four children, four boys, and made a real effort to make sure that they had a really, really strong family unit. But now they're out on their own.
Right.
And I'm not sure they're any more connected.
Well, I think, like, there's just, somewhere else in the book, I talk about, this James Wright poem called A Blessing. And it's about these two ponies that these guys stop and see. And these two ponies come right over. This is a paraphrase. They come right over because they've been grazing all day alone. And so the two ponies are obviously close. And then the line is, they love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. You know, and when I teach that poem, students often say, like, they love each other. There's no loneliness like theirs. What? You know, like, you know, and then we talk about how love is makes you aware of your isolation, because, like, you can never actually, like, be the other person. You know, they love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. You know, for me with my siblings, I feel that there's those limits. And in families too, there's always tension between the individual and the group, right? So when you're totally yourself, and I often say this to my students, when you're writing, you can't be a daughter. You can't be a sister or a brother or a son. You can only be you. You know, there can be collateral damage when you're writing because you're not, like, participating in the group, in the groupness of your family unit. So I think there's just a lot of tension around that. And we also have the sort of, I call it upper and lower family, the three older ones who grew up close together.
Yeah.
And then there's a middle child who kind of, he really is sort of a diplomatic genius. He can go with, he can be the youngest of the oldest or the oldest of the youngest.
Yep.
But I know I'm aware of the fact that I'm not part of those older three, but mm-hmm. I kind of love how they are together. I don't feel a need to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I also really love, like, my junior four, the four that I'm in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And these dynamics definitely played a role in our, you know, when our parents were dying and things, because my mother died 3 years ago. My father died in 2001. And I'm glad that I understood those dynamics could be useful, the upper and lower family, like during those experiences.
How did that manifest?
Well, just that certain people were sort of back to the Grier. Certain people communicated better or could lend their sight to other people. And my parents sort of assigned powers of attorney across those. So there'd be like like a younger and an older sibling, like a number one and a number two. And so there's just loving ways that those things over time can also, even though it may feel like isolation, there's really richness in the one-to-one relationships that one creates across those boundaries, I think. But also, I don't know, maybe it's a function of how big it is. Like, we have seven, you have five. And so there's if you're in that lower two, it really feels smaller than that upper three, whereas the three and four doesn't feel that way.
That is true. Plus, the lower two were further apart in age. So, you know, there was the three of us, and then, let's see, so, and then 4 years later was my sister, and then, was that what it was? 63, no, 3 years later was my sister, and then another 4 years later was the little one. So they weren't really close, the two younger weren't that close in age to each other.
Well, and I'm lucky too. We were farther apart too. The lower ones are all, well, three of us are 4 years apart, and the oldest two of the smaller group are like you guys. They're like only a year apart or 2 years apart. But I don't know. My brother Phil, who's 4 years older than me, I can see how that would have been difficult. The gender difference, the age gap, but he's just a very loving brother who always really unusually so valued family and still does. And so I think, and he pulled me out of my introversion a lot as a child. He was more outgoing. He's the one in that same essay we've been talking about. He's the one playing the little league game.
Ah,
right.
Right. Right.
And so even there, like that's a good metaphor for the isolation. Just for those who haven't read the book, there's like this point where I, as like a 5-year-old, go and leave my brother's little league game and go back and sit in a car. And then I suddenly realize, like, metaphysical dilemma, like that I'm in a stranger's car, that I open the door to the wrong car. And, you know, it should be kind of a terrifying scene, but it isn't. And then I just, you know, then someone leads me back, I think, to the game. But if you think about the whole issue of feeling left out of a family unit or where do you fit in, that's a good example of like, okay, I went and I had like a moment of crisis that was existential in nature, or even a moment of beauty that was private. And then I went back to my brother's game, and that essay ends with me wondering, like, as I hear cheers, whether my brother, you know, scored a run or whatever. And so I think, like, sometimes, especially Phil, my brother, who's only 4 years older, but who's closest in age to me, like, would pull me towards life or towards those more sort of family experiences, which, if you think about a boy growing up in the 70s, is pretty, you know, unusual that he was always connected.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Carol Ann Davis, author of The Nail in the Tree, Essays on Art, Violence, and Childhood. So throughout these essays, you have a lot of poetic references and artistic references. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as you sit down to write an essay, like, are you starting with, okay, I want to express something about about siblings, or something about, I don't know, what are some of the other, you say, things?
Yeah.
And do you go look for poetry and art that fits in that? Or are you starting from, you know, you have this piece of poetry and you think, I want to expand on what this poet is saying?
I think that it's like a totally, I never ever have an idea in mind when I'm writing either an essay or a poem. I just go with the poems, I generally go from a tiny scrap of language. And in the essays, I will just notice that I am living with something. I am living with an artist. I'm living with, I'm like continually looking at Arshile Gorky's paintings, or I'm reading, Aline Cissé is another big influence in this book. She's like a French theorist and essayist. And I'll realize that I'm thinking about this person art a lot. And then I'll realize that it's not a poem. And then I'll go, okay, I'll write a paragraph. I'll write a paragraph, see what I think. And then it kind of goes from there. And you'll notice the book moves sort of paragraph by paragraph. It doesn't really move essay by essay.
Yeah, you're right, it does. Now, that makes it, what would you say? You have to really be paying attention when you're reading this.
Yes.
So it's not
Between
just.
that and the poetic language, it's a really hard read, I think, in some ways, because the language is also not normal prose.
Yeah, it's very poetic, it's very literary.
But it's also like compressed almost to an annoying degree, I would say, like the things I say. Like I noticed when I was proofing it, I kept wanting to put in like more these and A's, and I was like, no, the language is tight for a reason, you know?
I don't know that I would say it's annoying, but
Yes, the author can say
right. As a writer, I tend to like spare language anyway, so to me it's appealing. So and I've been slammed for it though.
Well, I was worried, I was like, but then again, the subject matter with there's an ethical dimension to the style of it that's like, okay, reader, stop and think about this. This is a big subject. This is an important moment in American history. If we're gonna stop and go slow, Sandy Hook is one of the subjects I think we should be willing to do that with. Not that I put up barriers linguistically, but I think I did want a lot of space for people to stop, put the book down, decide to go back. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I think the paragraphs being titled, sometimes there's like a paragraph and it has a title, and then another paragraph and it has a title. You might just read one paragraph one day. So,
And really, and yeah, because you have to really think about that paragraph. You do need time to think about it.
and even I don't know everything. Like all this stuff we're talking about my brother, like those are not things I consciously think when I'm writing it. It's only when I reread that I go, oh my goodness, look how Philip is pulling me out of my isolation and back to the game,
And that circles back to this theme of being led, which is that the same essay, the being led?
Yes.
So, you were told as a child that you were gullible
Yes.
and easily led.
Well, so everybody called me gullible, and my father said, she's not gullible, she's easily led. He was like making a distinction.
Okay. And what is the distinction?
I think he was saying that there's a spiritual benefit to being easily led.
Okay, so yes, because in many kind of spiritual traditions, you are supposed to, it's considered ideal to let go of the will,
Yes, surrender.
surrender. And you also talk about how important that is in writing.
Right.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, so I was talking about sort of, I was almost talking about that when I was talking about living with a poem or a piece of language, and then going, okay, well, now I'll go and I'll write a paragraph or that's being led, in my opinion. You know, you're being led toward your subject or toward your preoccupation. You're allowing yourself to be led towards subject, toward even conclusion. Like, you know, you're not making conclusions. So the way I think about writing, I'm always wanting to be led deeper into something. I'm not looking to be, to tell or explain. I'm looking to explore what's opening to me because I'm letting go all the time.
So, Carol Ann, would you read from one of the essays for us?
Oh, sure. Let's see. I'm going to look inside the essay we've been talking about.
Okay.
I was looking at the way in which my own childhood and my children's childhood go together. Maybe I'll read this passage from this essay that we've been talking about. Is called The Practice of School Buses and Hummingbirds. And maybe I'll read two paragraphs from that essay that go together about, that mention the hummingbird and mention surrender.
Okay.
Perfect. And also, sound okay?
Sure.
Okay. So this paragraph is called As I Knew It as a Child, and it's, okay, so I'll start there. As I knew it as a child, I cannot write what I cannot see, but I can feel what I can't, but can I feel what I can't see? Yes, I have learned again this year what I knew as a child. This year, and by this year, I wrote this the year of the shooting. This year has brought back to me how tenuous the world seemed to me as a child, must feel for all children. The many things children know because of what they have seen with their own eyes boggles the mind. Sometimes I catch myself actually happy to hear that some children have blocked what they've seen. In our town, we are careful. We have been trained not to suggest images children may not have seen, images they have missed. And then I quote Rumi here, speak not of what you have not seen. We live by this and hope for some mercy, that at least some of them will be shown the mercy of the not seen, will be bathed in a playful blankness rather than end up on the difficult long road toward but never at surrender. So then that's one paragraph. The next paragraph is called the Grier. Meanwhile, I am being led backwards from the beginning. Looking at my boys, I sometimes have the thought, what from my own childhood don't I know? At times, certainly, my siblings and I resembled the Grier. I find out from research that the Grier shared not only one eye, but also one tooth. I can name each eye and tooth in my family, each blindness or hunger. One sibling who could read the tone of the room. Another who had an insatiable appetite. A third with a silver tongue. Each of us passing our one gift to the other for filial use, together compromising one whole. My gift, I was small and could hide. Also, I had a photographic memory and brought back intelligence from my hiding places. Who could use what I offered the group of us? In a family, the whole is never totally in view. One passes eye and tooth to someone else and is happily, easily led by one's pack of Grier toward what one never discovers. I simply liked the blind sound of them near me.
Would you also read the beginning of the essay Loose Thread?
Sure. The essays generally have like an artist and some writer reference. So this is a poem by Paul Celand. I think this is the whole poem. I hear the axe has flowered. I hear the place can't be named. I hear the bread that looks on him heals the hanged man, the bread his wife baked him. I hear they call life the only refuge. And now the essay begins. When a loose thread needs pulling, though pulling it means in some ways untangling the present moment from before in ways that admit the enormity of grief, that's when I write. What of the afterlife ties itself to the other end? What song will I hear whose voice might never again sing in my presence? In the present moment, my two boys are arguing with children whom they love more than anything as friends visit on a lazy Saturday before Labor Day. But even so, there are too many children and too few adults. So after infractions, only the children witnessed, our afternoons turn to a post-mortem of crimes that occurred when adult supervision lagged. The explanations dissemble into poorly understood grudges, willful misunderstandings. It's a drawn-out and deeply felt disagreement in which one holds tight to his grain of truth, the thing that escalated the argument, and the other accuses him of just making things up. Let the thread fall loose, I want to say. Love each other in short and fading light. All that knows you best, all that loves you back, is held within the walls of this room. Instead, the thread that needs letting go, pulls everything tight. After half an hour, it could cut a diamond, and does. The shining day, one of the last that will be crisp and warm enough for outdoor play before winter comes, any game, pick it and go, yet all of them opt to stay inside. When a loose thread needs pulling, sometimes don't pull. The way they argue over a narrative they all frame differently has me thinking about the ethics of language, how a narrative sometimes detaches the image from its surroundings. In the case of argument, images can be produced to substitute for reason, to provide a tidy narrative, or to illustrate a wrong deeply felt among many possibilities. The image's symbolism detaches it from the realities of the experience and from its original ethical framework. Soon what was real once, shared between friends, becomes an instrument of individual interpretation, the image standing in for a set of ideas, ordering a world that might rightly remain pleasantly disordered forever had the arguer not brought an interpretation to bear. Severed from narrative, the image could have a different life. In our small dining room, thick with discord, the image stays inside its narrative. Someone is lying and someone is telling the truth, or so the kids tell me. For now, each takes their individual truth into a different privacy to cultivate it. And when the children go home, they will leave unsure when they'll again play as easily with each other as they once had. Like the Apostle Thomas presented with Christ's scars, I remain unsure about the assumptions attached to the process of moving thing toward idea. I wonder if the children, asking their pointed questions, wanted answers but didn't mean to hurt each other as they asked them. Maybe Thomas, asking as he did to see the scars on Christ's hands, did not need proof of Christ's suffering, but instead wanted to experience that suffering himself, to be with the scar as if he was the scar, the better to participate in the suffering of his friend. I don't tell the kids this, but seeing that each has a scar, I wish they could find a way to share rather than nurse them alone. If friends agree on the real, what of the real might truce its way to common understanding? For some aspects of the real, such an understanding can be found, but aren't others, I don't know what to say, too sacred for interrogation? These children who spend their Saturday arguing mightily over soccer jersey have watched their playmates' parents pass by them disconsolate. Some have attended the funerals of friends. The number lost was higher than some could count at the time, higher than the older ones want the younger ones to know. Years have passed since the shooting at Sandy Hook School in our town, On this Saturday before the new school year starts, 5 Christmases stand between these children in that moment. And today, though their arguments seem trivial, their words have an edge. I don't pull that thread.
And that was Carol Ann Davis reading from The Nail in the Tree, Essays on Art, Violence, and Childhood. So you mentioned early on that much of your writing is about your children.
Yes.
And I believe, based on what I can deduce, your oldest must be like 17 now, something like
that. He will be 17 very soon, this month, yes.
Has he read any of this, and how does he feel about it?
Well, if you've had teenagers, you'll know that you don't always know how they feel about things.
Well, that is true.
But he has read. He copy-edited this book a few years back. This book took a long time to come to press, although I'm glad it took this long. I was very, like, I surrendered to that process. Two summers ago, so he would have been 14 or 15, he kind of proofed most of the book for me. In some ways, my older boy, Willem, is, I don't know, in some ways, I was going to say this book is almost a lot about Willem, because that first essay is kind of, well, in this narrative, in this little passage I read about the older kids not wanting the younger kids to know certain things, mm-hmm. is a dynamic in the book between my older son and my younger son, who had different paths to understanding the tragedy. And so for Willem, you know, which in the first essay you find out that he finds out on the day of.
Right.
So in some ways, his experience of this book, I think, is tied up with his desire to understand he kind of propels in some ways. He propelled me to talk about it with my husband and me and my older son sort of trying to figure out and negotiate when and how to tell Luke, which I think in loose thread, my younger son gets told about it. But so I think Willem understands. He's a writer too. He's a creator. He wants to be a filmmaker. The project of creating art or of externalizing these experiences is something that he gets. A lot of people have asked me about, like, oh, you write a lot about your children. You know, what are the ethical dilemmas there? And I guess I feel like I'm writing about my experience of raising them. So that isn't like, it isn't really their story. They'd have to write that.
You're not trying to write from their point of view.
No. I mean, they appear. They say things.
Yeah.
No. They say, like, The Nail in the Tree, the title is from something that Willem said to me.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So, you know, that I tell this in the preface of the book, but that in the year following the tragedy, so he would have been 9, or maybe he had turned 10 by this point, but he said that the tragedy felt like a nail driven into the tree, and he's the tree, or we're all the tree, and, you know, we're going to keep growing, and we're going to have to in the end. You can't pull the nail out because that would hurt the tree more. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of love the tree, and you have to love the nail.
Because the tree grows around the nail and,
yes,
and kind of encompasses it.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think he feels attributed, you know, he feels in some ways he, I don't know if he's joking or not, but he doesn't remember saying that to me. And it's a very beautiful image. So he's sort of like, you wrote that image and you're saying, but in some ways for me, that's a beautiful, that's the image itself. That's him. That's his big tree-ness growing over and covering the nail that he doesn't remember saying that. Mm.
Yeah.
Like that child sense of the world that I was reading about with the hummingbird essay. What don't you know that your child self did know? You know, that idea. There are already, I'm watching him like grow over things that he knows. I mean, he knows them in his deep back brain, but he doesn't remember saying that to me.
Oh, I really get that, because there's so much that children seem to come into the world knowing that they lose along the way too.
Yes.
They forget.
Exactly.
And I wrote a song about that once, that had a word like something about the wisdom of ages in the child's eyes when they can't even say it, but you can see what they know.
Yes.
Yeah. And my daughter, when she was little, would tell these stories about, she'd say, well, when I was the mom and you were the kid, this is how we did things.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, Willem would say, when he was really young, like, my first book is about the year my father died and I became pregnant with Willem, and the sort of like weird way in which pregnancy and grief kind of interacted. And then when Willem was like three, he would say, your father was so jolly. He had such a belly and you could lay your head on it, and scratchy chin. And I was like, nope. Yep. That's all right. And you could not know that.
Oh, wow.
You know, like,
yeah.
And it was like the whole idea that the afterlife and the pre-life have something in common, or that children have some kind of. And even I have a colleague who's a Jesuit priest. He's 83, and we have these amazing conversations. He was in the Middle East for 20 years, and he's just like sort of the definition of a seeker. You know, he's just a seeker. It's just, and we talk about how, like, his, we had this conversation recently about possibly children understand death because birth is like a near-death experience, and it doesn't go away very soon, so that young children are aware of death in a way that they forget.
That makes sense. That really does.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Carol Ann, you mentioned that this book took a long time to come to publication.
Yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that story? What the?
Right. You do a little bit with publishing.
Yeah.
On so I'm with a wonderful independent press called Tupelo Press. I'll give them a plug. You can find them at tupelopress.org. They're widely a poetry press, but they also do prose. And I was semi-ambivalent, as you can imagine, for many years about exactly what a book would look like that included material about Sandy Hook. I'm very, very protective, obviously, of Sandy Hook and my experience and my friends here. And so I wasn't even sure I wanted to publish anything. So there were years of me talking with my publisher about exactly what it might look like. So there was that. And then there's just the fact that independent presses only have a certain number of spots every year. And then there was some production pushback where it was like, it seemed like it got pushed a little. And then I decided to push it myself into the new year, because I kind of didn't want it to come out late in the year. And I also had no desire for it to come out sort of at the anniversary of tragedy, because I feel like there's just enough. And I don't have a huge desire for attention to come to the town over this book. Not that it would. Independent presses are small things, but I just felt
you didn't want to be looking like you were trying to capitalize on it.
Right. And I think the book is kind of a strange animal. If someone's looking for sort of prurient detail about, you know, any kind of aspect of this event, it's just not a tell-all book in that way. And I don't think there ever will be one, because it's just not who we are, or how we how the town processed and continues to process the event. So there's a ton of sacredness involved in approaching this book for me. Luckily, because it was a small press, when I said, can we just push it into the new year, they're like, sure, you know. So some of it was that. Some of it was you know, me just being like, not this time of year.
Mm. Now, some of these essays had been published before, correct?
Yes, most of them, because okay. That's sort of the way it goes in publishing, small press publishing, and also literary publishing. So like the Georgia Review had published a few of these. And yeah, I think most of them had appeared somewhere.
And you've been an editor of a literary journal yourself in the past.
Yes, I edited Crazy Horse, and I also, at the moment, I edit Dogwood, which is the magazine at Fairfield University, the literary journal.
And how does that you're writing and you're editing, and do you flow seamlessly between the two, or do you have to kind of put on different hats for each of those tasks?
Well, I would say there's kind of three different areas. They help each other, but they don't exactly interact. It's teaching, writing, and editing. So, you know, teaching young writers and also teaching young editors. I do both of those. And then, so when you're teaching, you're trying to make students aware of sort of the craft elements that underpin the different genres, and also this idea of being led. You're kind of teaching them about that kind of surrender that writing requires. And you're encouraging them, and you're creating a community of writers that encourage each other. With editing, it's the opposite. And this is the worst, when I have like a student who's in my writing workshop, and then they come and they're in my editing class, and they start saying like, this could be a lot better if they just blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, if we were in a workshop with them, we would tell them that. But since we're an editor, we're simply going to write no. And they're like, but can't we send them a note? I'm like, nope. Our job actually is to reject this piece.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
And then I'm like, and so you'll know when you get rejected that person is not personal. It's just their job to reject you right now because you're not ready. And they're going to have a teacher explain to them why, but you're not the teacher.
Oh, wow. That must be hard to do, though, if you're...
Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah.
So it's sort of like, and then I make them get faster at rejection, you know, like, okay, you did 20 this week. Next week, you have to do 100. You don't have enough time to actually do 100 the way you did the 20. So,
oh my goodness. So like for a literary journal, how many submissions do you get for every one that you accept?
Well, it depends on the journals. Mm-hmm. You know, so like I want to say Dogwood's probably at like 7%.
Acceptance?
I think we get like 800 to 1,000 submissions, and we take 25.
Wow.
Wait, that's less.
Yeah,
right?
That's a lot less than 7.
Well, but it depends. It's also genre. It's like we take 3 or 4 essays and we get 100.
Okay. Okay.
We take 15 poems or 20 poems and we get 400.
Okay.
But there are journals. I mean, Crazy Horse used to get thousands and thousands of submissions, and we had two issues a year. And
wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty astronomical. Like, I went up for a promotion a couple years ago, and I had to write to editors to get like their acceptance rates. And some of them are like, well, let's not put it in percentages. Let's say we take 30 poems and we get 4,000.
Well, you can obviously do the math and get the percentage.
It's more effective to be like, or like, yeah, I mean, some of them are like 0.0125%.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, Carol Ann, this is another interesting topic we could go on about.
Yes,
but
sure.
we are actually out of time.
Okay.
So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Monica, for having me.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.